Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. Today we take a special look at the current state of the Australian property market with a special focus on the coalface at Melbourne's. After a tumultuous 2020 that saw rocky and rebounding equity markets, emergency stimulus and both rental eviction moratoriums and bankruptcy protections. Add to this the snapping shut of international rivals, and it would be safe to assume that even our most resilient of markets, property, would be showing signs of pressure under these circumstances. For those states enduring lockdowns, this was particularly true as inspections and auction opportunities became limited and sales volumes slowed. The story quickly changed, however, as the lockdowns eased, with an explosive mix of pent-up demand, record low interest rates, and the hunger for space and lifestyle, seeing both cyclical regions and urban detached housing catapult prices with vigour. Well, at least that's what the papers are telling us. But thankfully, here at Nucleus Investment Insights, we have our own frontline intelligence to help colour in the picture through our special guest and friend of the show, Catherine Cashmore. Catherine is an author, president of the tax reform think tank Prosper Australia, and director of the respected real estate advocacy firm Cashmore & Co. So, Catherine Cashmore, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thanks so much. It's really good to be here.
Terrific to have you on. Nearly, almost exactly a year, I think. So, yeah, we've bookended COVID well. Also joining us in the studio and fresh back from a rare interstate holiday and primed with some terrific charts for national coverage, we're lucky to be joined by our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. Hello to you, Leith.
Yeah, g'day, Tim. Hi, everyone.
And rounding out the experts and sharing his views on Aussie housing and its relevant impact on the portfolios, we have Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Full house today. Big show. So just a quick reminder as well before we get started, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So we can jump into our agenda for today. So we're going to start with the strongest growth in property prices since 1988. We're going to be moving into mortgage market statistics, which it's booming. Also looking at the auction market, tying back around then to lack of supply, and then looking to the future and how long this boom may run. So a slightly different vibe to what has often been our property scene over the last few years at Nucleus Wealth and Australian property. So looking forward to it. So let's kick it off. Let's head over to our first slide. And Leith, strongest property growth since 1988.
Yeah, that's right, Tim. Look, I won't bore everyone too long about going on about how strong the property market is, but I'll just give a very quick snapshot about just how strong this current boom is. Now, it seems like old news now, but the March, the month of March, CoreLogic Dwelling Values Index registered its strongest growth since 1988, and it was also, and this growth was broad based. It was effectively across every single capital city across Australia, and also every single regional area. So effectively, we're witnessing our first synchronised housing boom that I can certainly remember in living memory, and it's happening pretty much everywhere across the country. And it's also worth noting that quarterly price growth as of yesterday was the strongest since 1989. So the strongest monthly growth since 1988 in March, and currently the strongest quarterly growth nationally since 1989. So basically, we've got ourselves here a synchronised property boom, the likes of which we haven't seen for generations. And I'll just click across the next slide, which basically shows the underlying drivers of this boom. And as expected, it gets down to the main factor is obviously the mortgage market. Pretty much everyone who buys a property in Australia is leveraged through the mortgage market. They borrow money. Every time the Reserve Bank cuts interest rates, people go into the bank and they borrow more money and they spend more on property. And that's kind of what we're seeing. And the mortgage data underscores this in that the March new mortgage finance commitments in March were the strongest on record. On Australia, on the ABS's record, And unlike previous booms, this growth is actually being driven by owner-occupiers rather than investors. And not just that, the first home, it's also been driven to a large extent by first home buyers. And in fact, first home buyer demand for only the second time in decades, the other time being briefly during the global financial crisis for about 1 month, first home buyer mortgage demand is actually stronger than investors at the moment. So it's kind of an unusual boom in that it's been driven by owner-occupiers this time around, whereas the previous few cycles have been driven predominantly by Melbourne and Sydney and have been driven by investors. And anyone who's watching this live can see that the right chart there in the pane showing that there's a really strong, and as you'd expect, a very, very strong correlation between mortgage growth and dwelling value growth, with mortgage growth typically leading. And so this ginormous boom in mortgage demand, new mortgages that is obviously pointing to ongoing strong price growth for the foreseeable future. And this has been, if we just skip to the next chart, the boom in mortgage commitments has also been matched by auction clearance rates. So according to CoreLogic, over the March quarter, the national auction clearance rate was the highest on record. It's never been this high. This is important really only for Sydney and Melbourne, because Sydney and Melbourne are the only markets where auctions are, you know, very prevalent. The other markets are typically private sale. But regardless, again, just like mortgage finance, we've got booming auction market, and that's also a pretty good historical leading indicator for price growth in Sydney and Melbourne. So again, it's just another one of these bullish indicators. And if you just skip along to the next one, at the same time as we've got this boom in demand through mortgages and auctions, etc., we've also got actual supply in the form of listings. So this is different to structural supply in terms of how many dwellings are built. This is how many homes are actually on the market. Structural housing supply, the number of homes for sale is running way below the five-year average, way below comparative times in the previous years, whereas the number of homes actually selling is running way above the decade average, and that's been driven by the detached house market. So we've effectively got a situation where there is a shortage of stock for sale amid insatiable demand, and that's obviously combining to force prices higher. It's also creating FOMO in the market, the fear of missing out, whereby people are obviously, you know, sticking their hand up at every opportunity at auctions, going probably above what they want to pay, purely because they don't want to miss out. So it's FOMO's returned. Some separate data released last few days by Martin North at the Digital Finance Analytics also shows that the Bank for Mum and Dad, which is the lending from mums and dads to the children, is now running at a record high as well. Which helps explain the boom in first home buyer demand, in that children are now tapping their parents for funds to also get into the market, presumably on the back of FOMO.
Yeah, and isn't it? This is a part where, you know, we put something out a few days ago, just sort of highlighting that it's never been cheaper to pay the interest on your mortgage, but it's never been more expensive relative to wages or relative to rents in terms of being able to actually afford to pay off your mortgage or save up for that deposit. Mm. So yeah, it makes sense that, you know, people who are going, yes, I can afford this mortgage, but there's no way I can possibly save up enough money to do it, but mum and dad will lend me the money and
give you the head start.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So that's effectively, if we just skip along to the next chart, I'll just give it a very quick rundown. And finally, obviously, it's also worth looking at the rental market. Surprisingly, rental growth nationally is actually running at its highest level in 11 years.
Rental growth.
Actual growth in rents.
Yep. Okay.
Which is kind of perverse, given the fact that we've got we've had collapsing population growth because of immigration. But according to CoreLogic, the change in rents, so actual rental growth, is running at its highest level in 11 years.
Yeah. So they're saying something different to SQM's got some different data, I think, in terms of that.
Yeah. Possibly. But at least CoreLogic showing that that rental growth is the highest and the strongest in 11 years, and this has been driven mostly by detached houses. Pretty much every market other than Sydney and Melbourne high-rise apartments, or the Sydney and Melbourne apartment market, is experiencing positive growth, and some of them, Perth, Darwin, less Adelaide, lesser extent Brisbane, are all experiencing very, very strong detached house and rental growth. So we've got this situation where prices are growing, rents are also growing, but because prices are growing faster than rents, actual rental yields have fallen to their lowest level on record. Mm. But because mortgage rates have fallen so much, there's still the opportunity to buy a positively geared investment property outside of Sydney and Melbourne, which helps to explain why. It also helps to underline why, to hit so-called equilibrium, given the low mortgage rates we've got, prices probably have to rise to normalise with interest rates.
And when you say positively geared, you're talking about from a gross yield perspective.
That's right.
I think Martin talked to Martin North about this, about the on a net yield. He sort of does it for people after it, and I think it's
still a little bit down.
Well, I think it was 70% of people were losing money on their houses, on their investments.
Yeah, that probably makes sense, but at the same time, it's probably never been a better spread, I guess, between.
Oh, this is yeah, absolutely. If you look at the net rental yield to the interest rate, it's never been better.
That's right. Yeah. So, which sort of helps to explain why I got this domain. And the thing about it is, it's at the moment the boom's been driven by owner-occupiers, but presuming the financial regulators don't step in and squash it. Etc. My view is that we'll probably end up having a sort of baton pass from owner occupiers to investors some point soon, because the rental yields are, I guess, the yields on offer are still pretty decent, and there's not really that many other places to put your money. So, so I think there's still a bit of steam to go into the market. As for how long it lasts, I guess this is something we can ask Catherine. Damien can give his view, etc. But I think it's, we're looking at very strong price growth. Obviously, it's not exactly a bold statement in this calendar year, and probably decent growth next year. But I think it'll probably start to stall out sometime next year. But again, it all depends on these factors. Like, will financial regulators step in to put in some macroprudential curves like they did pre-Royal Commission?
Will the term funding facility be renewed? Up?
That's right. Will the Reserve Bank do some funny money with their term funding facility to lower fixed mortgage rates even more? There's a whole lot of factors that could go either way. But I guess...
Quick question for you, Leith. Yep. Yeah, so just with that annual change in rents, obviously last year had a lot of external forces on rents, so the rent, rent reductions and holidays and postponements and those sort of things. Was it made mention in the data that those, because obviously when you've got big wild swings from the norm, there's been some external intervention in there. So has that been sort of factored into that, do you think?
I don't think so, because the data leading up to the start, when rents started rising, you think if the rent moratoriums and all that sort of stuff would be factored in, you'd see a fall in rents and then a rise in rents. Mm-hmm. But the data didn't show that.
Right.
It did show that rents have been weak for a number of years.
Yep.
But then in the last sort of 8-9 months, it started to spike.
Oh, yeah, it's phenomenal, isn't it?
It is.
The fact that there's no the immigration tap's been slammed shut, and it's really just Australians paying more for rentals then, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
New Australians.
And it could come down to the fact that there's so much, extra disposable income to a degree.
Yep.
And also, I mean, obviously the high-rise apartment market in Sydney and Melbourne is completely kaput, especially in Melbourne.
Mm.
And there's been a bit of a pivot away from apartments towards detached houses. People want to live in detached houses. The regional areas are absolutely booming, rents and prices. So there's been sort of a swing away to lifestyle areas and et cetera, a bit of work from home.
Mm.
But still, it is strange that you got the lowest population growth that this country's seen in decades. And... actually negative net overseas migration in the last few quarters.
It's pushing rents up.
And yet rents are rising. So it is bizarre. And also, obviously, dwelling construction, which wouldn't be factored in yet, but dwelling construction is going through the roof because of home builder.
Yep.
So we're now, I didn't bother putting that in this chart pack, but actual construction activity in the addition of dwellings is rocketing right now.
Yep.
They haven't been built yet, but they're currently under construction. And you'd expect that would add to the oversupply as well and obviously push down... at the margin, prices and rents going forward. So it's a kind of weird market.
Yeah, and this is – sorry, I've just pulled up the SQM data just to compare. So they're basically saying, say, for Sydney, over the last month, unit rents are down 0.1, housing's up 0.6. Over the last 12 months, units are down 6, housing's up 0.1, which I'm guessing is a bit higher than, a fair bit lower than what you're sort of seeing in those states. It's hard to tell. It's not quite on the same base. There's obviously a huge spike in those ones there, isn't it? But whereas it's saying,
and Sydney and Melbourne is weaker. So like the rest of the economy, the rest of the markets are experiencing much stronger rents than Sydney and Melbourne, even for houses as well.
And that's certainly true of these. That's only consistent with this one. But
It's interesting. So, Catherine, just a quick word. Wouldn't mind your thoughts on why we've got falling immigration and rising rents. If you've got anything to share on that before we jump into some frontline remarks.
Yeah, we can nuance the Melbourne market a little bit more than Leith's looking at there, because it's not just the units where rents are going backwards. In the inner city suburbs on houses and villa units, which are doing extremely well in terms of the buying market, so the prices are shooting upwards, there's no lack of demand, and investors are coming back into the market. But what we're seeing in suburbs like Caulfield, like Bentley, other sort of these kind of middle ring family suburbs, is the vacancy rates are up around 5% and 6%. And these suburbs, even though they have had a lot of apartment building in the past, that vacancy rate is spreading to the housing sector and other units, so townhouses and villa units, and they are having to reduce their rents. And I think the reason for this is because Melbourne went through such a difficult situation last year. A lot of people have migrated away from Melbourne, and that's what you're seeing is just a shift in the population from Melbourne and Sydney, so the more expensive states, to places, you know, like WA, like Perth and Brisbane and South Australia. You know, even we've got even a population increase in the Northern Territory and Tasmania, you know, which is again where you're kind of seeing increases in rents. So that is all to do with internal migration, and in those markets the vacancy rates are below 1%. So they're extremely tight and a lot of competition. I mean, in Perth, you've even got the apartments that are increasing there in price. So Melbourne rental market is really, we know, right, that Melbourne's property market has been completely fed by population growth. That is a population coming in to Melbourne, and it's been fed by that. And now, of course, we still have the demand in the housing sector because of all this government stimulus and the interest rates. And not only that, but we need to look at what's going on with things like crypto. That type of money, that type of wealth that's being created is all going to find its way into the real estate market, because everybody needs real estate. It's the available, you know, livable land is there's only so much supply of accessible land. And so those drivers are still affecting Melbourne. But yeah, the rental in Melbourne, it's not just in apartments. It also is in houses, mostly in the inner and middle ring. If you go more, if you push out towards the outer suburbs or even down the coast, Aspendale and Edith Vale, those types of areas, the rental market's pretty good there. It's pretty tight. But closer to the city, it's a challenge.
Great remarks. Excellent. Yeah, so there's been a bit of decentralisation from the capitals, you feel, internally. So,
Catherine, can I ask you quickly? I mean, you're obviously a buyer's agent, so you probably go to auctions every single week and, you know, obviously make bids, etc. How hot is it on the ground? Like, is it as hot as this data suggests? And I know you work across Melbourne and Perth. You're obviously not in person in Perth, but what do you... Like, does the vibe on the ground, is that hotter than the data suggests, or is it about right, or what's your view there?
Yeah, it's as hot as I have ever seen it, and probably hotter. In fact, I mean, I had down that we'd boom after the COVID anyway, in terms of the cycle work that I do, you know, with the 18-year cycle and everything, the second half is typically stronger than the first half of the cycle. But the market as we're seeing it now is incredibly challenging. And even when I actually try not to go to auctions. I try and buy outside of auction wherever possible in a market like this, because you are not in any good position to win at an auction. And the problem that we've got is that even when you see a property and you think to yourself, okay, it's a strong market, you get all the numbers together, you have a quick look over your shoulder at the comparables because you're looking at yesterday, what happened yesterday, but even so, and then you add a little bit onto it and you think, okay, reasonably, I think this property is going to sell somewhere between this number and that number. And normally, in any normal market, so even leading up to COVID, we had a few really strong strong years leading into 2017. You could be spot on by kind of doing that in-depth analysis. And get to the other side of this, there's just nothing that compares to when you turn up to an auction thinking that something that's quoted, say, at 1.5 to 1.6, you're saying, I think it's going to go 1.75, maybe the high 1.7s, and then it booms to like 1.9, okay? And you're thinking, just really jaw-dropping stuff. And the only auctions I can tell you is that if I have to go to auction, I try never to. The only ones that I win are where I've got a buyer that has really got a budget that they say, we absolutely want this. We don't want to miss out. And, you stand there and you do whatever tactics you can to help them. But you've basically got to be the winning bidder. And that's where the prices are just extreme. And just incredible. So I've never seen anything like that before. And it is, you know, obviously in the outside of the apartment sector.
And can I just ask, so how long have you been working as a buyer's agent for?
Oh, gosh. Well, I started as a sales agent. So as a buyer's agent, maybe 12 years, something like that.
Okay, but so as a sales agent as well, you're probably 15 years in the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. As a sales agent, sure. Yeah, but it was strong. You know, we've had strong years where, you know, there's been years where there've been boom years like 2015, where you can see the market is increasing and you're having to kind of keep up with it. But the stuff that I've seen over the last few weeks has just been off the charts. And you know, you're turning up to auctions and neither you or the agents can really believe it. I've had buyers, you know, the buyers look like they're about to faint. It's incredibly challenging. The only way getting into a market like this, if you have to go to auction and you can't, it's not vendor expectation, folks. So the idea that you're sort of thinking, oh, you know, this is the agents that are underquoting. Yeah, there's a lot of underquoting. That's never going to stop, right? That's always gone on. That's always been the case, and it's not going to stop today. As long as they're not going to find any way of stopping it in the future, because there's numerous loopholes. But the agents. You know, even the agents that are quoting around where the reserve is. So they're saying, yeah, the vendor would happily sell at, you know, 1.6, and you're seeing a property sell for 1.9 under competition. I mean, that is, you know, what we're seeing now is honestly unprecedented, I feel. I feel that it's stronger than anything that we have seen previously. And even though we can speculate, okay, when they, you know, pull back the incentives, when they take away the incentives and we've got, you know, a lot of first home buyers and stuff, it'll cool down. You know, there might be a bit of a pullback at that point, but I feel that there is so much fuel to this fire that has been poured on the fire, not just in the incentives and the bank lending, but the infrastructure build. We have the biggest spend on infrastructure that we have ever seen, not only in Australia, but globally. So this isn't just an Australian pattern, this is a global pattern. The lack of stock and the low stock, that tends to be very cyclical as well. But, you know, vendors, if they don't have to sell, they're not selling right now. So it's a little bit the same thing as we were saying, you know, last year during COVID, that you're only going to sell if you have to. But when you're seeing prices rocketing upwards, and you feel pretty secure that, you know, you're hearing everything, consumer sentiment is great, and you know that there's a lot of fuel being poured onto this, I think a lot of people feel that they're going to be mad to sell. And there is a third thing that you didn't mention that I have noticed, and it is the first time that I've had quite a number of clients that are buying in cash. So these are older clients that have got, you know, 800,000 or whatever sitting in the bank. There's no point it sitting in the bank. It's not gaining any interest. They would rather put it in a property and get the yields, even in Melbourne, where the yields are lower, it pays them to buy a property here, speculate on the growth, and get a rental income.
And of course,
and that's quite common in Perth.
And of course, that won't be picked up in the mortgage statistics either, because it's paying with cash. So that's interesting. And can I just ask, so you've been doing a bit of work in Perth. How does the market there compare to Melbourne? Like, is it just as frenzied? I mean, the data suggests it is. Is that kind of what you're seeing?
There's not a lot of auctions in Perth either.
Yeah, it's mostly private sale. But
Yeah.
So the Perth, the sales process is very different to how it works in Melbourne. The agents there don't usually have to do more than one open. if they have to do one at all. So they can either, there's off, obviously a lot of off-market sales that are happening there. It's not that it's happening, it's a little bit, it's obviously hot in the, you know, suburbs that are closer to Perth, so it does kind of range a little bit. It's not so hot in some areas. But yeah, it's and they're also getting a lot of people that are travelling over from Melbourne. So people that are travelling over from interstate and buying there and speculating. So it's a different buying process. You have to move very quickly. And an agent, you know, doesn't necessarily, but the, you know, they'll run one open and then they'll sell the property. So the days on market are very short and there's very low stock. There's virtually nothing on the market. So if you want to buy in Perth, you've really got to do the legwork to try and find what's going on off market over there, create a few relationships with the agents. But yeah, incredibly hot. But the major difference, I mean, Perth, I feel, is going to have a much stronger run. And obviously, you know, that's going to be the same. In Brisbane, and you know, the same in these smaller states by population, so the smaller states and territories. But Perth, because it's gone nowhere for sort of 10 years, this again, it's coming from a much lower base, and the yields are extremely good in Perth. So there's a much stronger, right, push there for where prices can potentially go, and it you know, from investors really. As well, you know, sort of speculating.
There's been a lot of, some recent news about the resurgence of the investors sort of coming back into the market now, and, you know, obviously for a lot of good reasons. Are they, just to get a bit of a feel for, I guess, go back to the sort of front line at the moment, where are investors looking? Are they just falling back into the old track of where investors typically go? Or obviously they're being a bit myopic against the against apartments and the more traditional, perhaps lower-end investment grade as opposed to owner-occupier? Have you been, what sort of interest you've been getting from the investment side, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because obviously I only see the people that come to me and then my advice shapes what they end up buying. So
sure.
They're not even necessarily just focusing on Melbourne. You have to be really careful in the regional areas. You have to be careful not to get sucked in to buying something that's not going to go anywhere, you know, like going and running and buying in a new land estate or, you know, in some regional area that's got vast tracts of land that's controlled by developers. But the interesting thing that I think is worth taking note of, so first of all, yes, there's more investor inquiry that's coming in, you know, that's going to happen. But the interesting thing is I have had more inquiry from first home buyers. It kind of started before COVID that first home buyers were getting interested in the market because they missed out in 2018. Mm-hmm. They saw prices starting to fall and they thought they could get in. And then 2019 hit and the market just did a complete U-turn, right? We went shooting up. And then COVID hit and the same again. I think everybody, when COVID hit, was hanging around waiting to see what was going to happen. I had a chat with a first home buyer yesterday who called me, who said he'd waited through 2020 just thinking, oh, this is it. This is going to be the one where, you know, we can finally get in. And because now he's just horrified by what they're seeing. And these first home buyers, they're thinking like investors. They're not thinking like home buyers. Please, there's not one first home buyer who is familiar with this country or familiar in any way with the economics of this country that is thinking that they are buying a home. They're not buying a home. Housing is treated here as an investment, and they're buying with that in mind. And so, so whenever I talk to a first home buyer, there's a real height of concern that they want to buy something that's going to be a good investment, and then that shapes their decision. So first home buyers are really investors as well. And the question, and, you know, there's things in Melbourne like the shared equity scheme. You know, it's the question is, should we take advantage of all this kind of first home buyer stuff that's being offered to us, or should we just do the rent vest thing, you know, buy rent closer to the city, which is, you know, sometimes where their community is, and then buy further out. So there's a lot of thought of that going into it as well.
All right. Thanks for that.
And Catherine, so you spoke about problems, I guess, in terms of rental, quite high rental vacancies and everything in the that middle ring. Is that, I guess I look at the, so obviously those investors are just holding on though at the moment. They're saying, oh, well, I can't rent it, but, or, you know, I've got to take a lower rent. But property prices are going up, so who cares? Because I'm, you know, as long as something's coming in, then it doesn't really matter. Is that the way they're looking at it? or is it?
I mean, kind of. The rental market, I think for a lot of investors in Australia, no one is investing particularly for the yield. Maybe the apartment buyers are, and they've been hit really badly. I mean, what we've seen in the apartment market has been on a level never seen ever, I don't feel, before in Melbourne. I mean, the vacancy rate in the Docklands got to 18.8% in October last year. So, I mean, that is unbelievable. And yet there was not a flood that hit the market. So, you know, obviously there was, you know, the support from banks and whatever else that was being offered over the time. So we're seeing that starting to be filtered onto the market now. So the rental market is in real crisis. But, yeah, I mean, there's quite a few properties that I go through and, you know, these are the things that we talk about at Prosper such a lot. And I think there's a proportion of people that just don't believe us when we say there's a lot of properties that are empty out there that aren't rented. Mm. And there are quite a few properties that I go through where they are just sitting vacant because it's just not worth the effort and the time for someone to get, you know, to go through that effort of trying to get a tenant in, knocking the rent down, paying, you know, your property management fees and then the maintenance fees. And then there's been all this hoo-ha. I mean, look, the rental laws are fine. You know, you've got to have, but there's, you know, there's costs, obviously maintenance costs that come throughout the year when you're owning a property. So, you know, for those people that are obviously reliant on it, maybe it's not as many as we think, but it's certainly not encouraging more property supply to come onto the market. I can give various stories about it. There was, you know, somebody who called me actually from overseas, from Israel, who owns a property in Caulfield, which for anyone who's not Melbourne bound is a, you know, very pricey suburb. He owned this property in Caulfield North, so very pricey, very sought after. Property prices do extremely well there. He's got like a 3-bedroom villa unit in that area and has never had a problem renting it before and was renting it for, I don't know, I think for about 550, 530 maybe a week leading up to this. It's now vacant. The tenant moved out to buy because, mm-hmm. you know, it's making a lot more sense for tenants to buy than it is to rent in some situations. And he just cannot get that property rented. And so his conversation with me was, you know, what should I do? The only thing he can do is just to keep lowering the rent until somebody moves into it. But when we looked at what was happening to prices for that type of stock, I mean, the prices are going through the roof. So, I mean, he could sell it, you know. But, and then the question was, well, if I sell it, where do I put the money? That's the money, right? Because, you know, what are your options then as to where you put the money? Is it better just holding on to it? So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are holding their properties vacant, but that, you know, they obviously would prefer to rent them. But I think that there is this just, you know, what do I do with the money if I sell? You know, do I have to reinvest back into property or am I going to go into, you know, REITs or, you know, where else am I going to put it?
Just a quick one on just... going back to the high-rise sort of side of things, and I guess, you know, you suspect, obviously, with as you mentioned before, 18% vacancy rates, it would, you know, surely there's been some impact on prices, but it doesn't feel like there's been a bloodbath.
No.
Has there been a bloodbath in high-rise?
So if anybody's watching live, go to macrobusiness.com.au. Just before lunchtime, about 11:40, I put up an article using domain data showing the bloodbath across the high-rise apartment sector in Melbourne. Yeah, so basically...
Sorry, in terms of prices or in terms of...
Prices.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. You're talking about
prices.
Yeah.
I'm talking about prices.
So basically, rents and prices have collapsed. So basically, this article has two sets of data. So it's got rents have fallen between 15% and 25% across all the inner-city areas over the year. But also, it's more anecdotal than actual... like. It just cites a whole bunch of real estate agents and people who've sold. And there's a couple of cases where, you know, someone bought a apartment in Carlton 15 years ago and has sold for 30% less than their buying price 15 years ago.
What?
And basically, all these real estate agents are saying that people are taking 30 to 40% haircuts on these. And one of them actually says that a whole bunch of people have sold their properties in the past recent months for 30% losses.
Mm.
So it's an absolute bloodbath.
Right.
And so If you're an investor, obviously, in these sort of high-rise inner-city areas in Melbourne, you are getting smashed on both sides because your rental income is obviously collapsing.
Yep.
Or you can't even rent them out.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
And then at the same time, you're taking a massive haircut on prices. And this all gets down to the fact that basically international students have gone.
Yeah.
They're not coming in. They were basically the household formation segment that filled in these apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And also, obviously, with work from home and less activity in the CBD, et cetera, yep. There's less reason to live here.
Yeah.
So it's an absolute bloodbath.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so conceptually, I guess it's an interesting question for everyone. And I'll put it to you first, Catherine, just in terms of your, thinking about your clients. You know, I guess everything's got a price, and it's the part where you said, well, okay, if it's $1,000 a week to rent a house with a three-bedroom house and it's $10 a week to rent an apartment, then maybe I'll move into an apartment because I'm going to save myself a hell of a lot of money. And so we go, you know, obviously there was a bit of a premium on houses before, and now we're seeing, you know, that diverging. And I guess the question is, you know, are we anywhere near the stage where you think people will start going, okay, it's now so much cheaper. It's now 30% cheaper, say, to rent an apartment, or do they need it to be 50% cheaper? Or I don't know. Are you getting any feel for that, Catherine, in terms of what people?
Well, I mean, obviously it depends who it is, because apartments are really great if you're single, right?
I was just going to say that. Yeah, different family, you know, family unit.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's no rush of families to apartments, and I can tell you from my own experience, because I don't own where I live. I rent, invest elsewhere. But from my own experience, renting in an apartment during lockdown was not the most fun experience to have.
Well, you could ask for rental reductions. That would have been the first thing you would have done, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's been the best thing about it. You're a winner if you're a renter and you've got that rent reduction. And obviously, as a renter, you can move with the wind.
Yeah.
You know, you can, most people can sort of up and move and take their pick if there's enough vacancies around. So, you know, what I would encourage tenants to do is you really need to be a little bit more proactive as a tenant. I think tenants seem to kind of live in this fear that if they ask for anything, it's going to cause them problems down the track. It's really not. The power's in your hands, and there is nothing wrong with negotiating a lower rent and using what's going on around you as evidence that you should be paying a lower rent. You know, not having to certainly at this point weather any rental rises. And the apartment, so the apartment market is a winner for renters. It always has been, and particularly now at this stage at the moment, and not just here, but also in Sydney. I've got friends in Sydney who are students over there, and they've had their rent reduced over $100 a week in Sydney in the apartment that they're living in. So this is a real win. There's, in my opinion, I mean, that is my opinion of how you should treat Australia's housing market. Buy for investment, because that is, you know, essentially what the housing market is. And then, you know, enjoy the lower rents in the apartments if you've got
opportunity. Well, it's funny you say that, because CoreLogic releases their pain and gain report every quarter. And what that basically shows is the proportion of sellers that made a profit on their property from their purchase price. And even before COVID, typically one in five to one in seven apartment owners across Australia were basically sold at a loss. And this is pre-COVID.
Well, but this is just raw numbers. This isn't accounting for
costs.
Stamp duties,
no.
And selling costs and all that type of stuff.
So basically, yeah, like one in five to one in seven people were already losing money on apartments pre-COVID. And now it's there's a little bit less in Sydney, because Sydney's a lot more apartment-centric and it doesn't have as many high-rise it's got low-rise spread out across the place.
Yeah.
But and now because of COVID, it's obviously gone up a lot worse than that. And so basically all that tells you is, especially the high-rise space, it's a pretty dud investment. But if you're a renter, fantastic. Mm. Especially Sydney and Melbourne, as that CoreLogic data shows. I mean, Melbourne's rents are down, I think, about 8% year-on-year. Sydney's are down about 5%. And that accounts for the low-rise apartments, which are doing better. So the high-rise have been slaughtered. So, you know, if you want to get yourself a cheap rental, go for it.
I might just add to that, because those pain and gain reports are actually really insightful when you dig into them. And that shows for anybody that is thinking about buying property, particularly as an investment, never, ever, ever get sucked in to this idea that you're buying an apartment and it's good because there's a lot of people downsizing into them. I think we've kind of blown that myth today that there really isn't and there's an oversupply. But that report does clarify that it is housing that has performed the best. And of course, it's performed the best because it sits on the land, and it's the land that appreciates and it's the buildings that depreciate. Mm. And all you own as an apartment is a tiny little bit of space in the sky, and you have no control over the amount of supply that's being developed. But if you take a bird's eye view of Melbourne or any other city, the push has always been up until now, and well, it still is now. It's just that we've got this little bit of what's happening with the COVID migration, people realizing that they can live a little bit further out if they want to and work remotely. But if you take a bird's eye view of the city, Melbourne has been zoned to increase density. Mm. So for the first time in Melbourne's history, we're building more up than we are out. And take that bird's eye view, and what you'll see is the 600 square meter blocks, which you can only get in the middle ring suburbs of Melbourne, you know, or Sydney. You have to go a little bit further out. The same in Brisbane. Those middle ring suburbs increasingly being subdivided into high density townhouses and apartments. And that means that the land sites are decreasing in supply. And to buy a suburban house on a block of a subdividable land is your best investment if you're really looking for price growth. And let's face it, that's what our market has been. Right now is a unique point in the cycle, and it's not going to last, where you can go to another city outside of Melbourne, as we've said, and buy a property where you've got a positive rental yield. But that won't last because the land prices are going to rise faster than the rents. So right now is
Or Catherine, you know, maybe one day interest rates might even rise a little bit is the other thing.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah. Because in the end, isn't that what we're coming back to is, and actually I'm quite interested in the rental growth part, but yeah, certainly within Sydney, Melbourne, rents are pretty much going nowhere. I think that's at the moment, or possibly
house rents are rising, but not that fast. But unit rents stink,
tumbling.
But I guess so. You know, you got to be your fundamentals of housing really in terms of affordability is people's wages going up or rents going up, and your
also rental yields. Sydney and Melbourne's rental yields are way way low, which means they're more overvalued.
Yeah, but then the thing that's driving it is the low interest rates. And so the question really comes back to saying, well, if the TFF, if the Term Funding Facility, which is where, just for anyone listening in, if that's where the RBA is lending to banks at 0.1%, so cheaper than what a state government can borrow at, the RBA will lend to the bank as long as the bank lends it out to somebody to get a mortgage. That's what's driving the low rents at the moment, and that's up in June, but I think it's going to get rolled again.
Yeah, no doubt.
But it's but I guess what all we're saying is we're in this artificial market where you're forcing it down, and that can go lower as well. We've spoken about in the past about Europe and how they're running at negative rates. So the European Central Bank actually gives banks money to lend, and so you can borrow in France or Germany at 0.5%. interest rates. So it's not like they can't go lower in interest rates, as much as, you know, even though they talk about the cash rate being zero, that it can definitely go lower. Even if the cash rate doesn't move, they can definitely get it lower. But it is this whole part about saying you're making this implicit. If you're making the implicit assumption that interest rates aren't going anywhere for a long, long time, then you can see where this is coming from. But you know, you add 1% to interest rates, which is if they took away the Term Funding Facility, that would immediately add 1% to interest rates. I would think that would put a pretty big dent in the market. Don't know about you, Catherine. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more to the price growth than just the lower on interest rates. There's a lot of drivers there that are pushing price. That's, you know, encouraging people to go out and buy land, and you know, as part of the cycle. But you know that I work with the 18-year cycle, and the 18-year cycle is, I believe, we synchronize with it. It's got a very long history in America and the UK, so we can trace that back. And that's due to peak around 2026. And what we always see towards the end of that cycle, and the thing that really triggers you know, one of the things that really triggers the collapse, and that is a rise in interest rates. But it has to be quite a rapid rise in interest rates outside of economic activity going up. So what we normally see with interest rates, obviously, is they're increased when the economy is improving, right? So outside of what we're seeing in the housing market right now, that's not, you know, where we are in Australia so much. But what you see at the end of the cycle is that interest rates have increased quite rapidly, as they were throughout 2006 into 2007. So very regularly at the, you know, multiple times throughout the year. And that really does then, that's what really puts a crack on the market, because you've sort of spent all this time eroding away the productive sectors of the economy. All the money's been flooding into speculation. And then the interest rates go up and you get this flood of foreclosures, you know, that hit the market. And then the banking fraud is, you know, just there. So definitely at some point they're going to go up. I don't think it's going to be so much in the shorter term. But it still stands that right now you have a you've got limited options as to where to put your investments. And right now is a very unique point that is not going to last if we still see this rate of growth in the housing market.
Quick question, actually, and I'm just sort of perhaps speaking for no doubt many people that are listening in, and actually speaking to some people that have reached out to us at Nucleus Wealth for investing money. Just reflections on the Sydney market. I'll use this one as an example. There's a gentleman who is basically stopped looking for his own home in Sydney because it's getting to a point, and this is in a Western Sydney, where you know, the area he was looking at was $1.5 million plus. And he wasn't even allowed to inspect. So that's how hot it's getting now. You're just basically buying blindly. And he, you know, took that as his mark to say, okay, well, that's enough. To somebody sort of in that position, or, you know, in any position, any value where they're just feeling like it's getting hot to the point where they're uncomfortable in making such a big purchase, obviously with such limited amounts of opportunity to assess, you know, is that like a point where you'd say, okay, well, in the next sort of 6 to 12 to 18 months, and obviously it's crystal ball gazing, but is, you know, for people in that sort of position, you know, is waiting out, you know, going to be the option, the only option for them, do you think? Or should they just go, okay, look, the inner west of Sydney's not for me anymore, I'm going to have to go somewhere where I can get an inspection?
Yeah, I mean, the last thing you want to do is just hang around and wait out and think, well, I'll just wait for prices to drop, because we know historically that what we normally get is around this kind of like 4, maybe even 5 years of strong price growth. I'm talking about Sydney and Melbourne. You can look at it in the recent history, because the other states didn't really go so far. But if you look, when we get these periods of price growth, it doesn't normally typically last, you know, 12 months. We have kind of like a run of it, and then you get something happening at the end of that, right? So. Yeah. It's not necessarily your best just to step out. What I always say to buyers, if you've got three P's, right, in the property purchasing process, you price your property and your position. Mm-hmm. Your price is the only fixed one. The other two are the ones where you have to make a compromise. And if you're going to auctions and you're missing out, you know, by 20 or 30 grand all the time, but you think you might still have a chance, in 12 months' time, you're still going to be in that situation. Mm. You have to make a move with what you're looking for, and you have to change your strategy. But I mean, I think a lot of buyers are getting weary, and that's perhaps one thing that people don't always think about. And that's the point where buyers say, okay, I've had enough, you know, of trying to do this because I keep missing out and I'm not going to do it anymore. Or, you know, conversely, you get people that increase their budgets at that point. They go back to the bank, they see whether they can get any more cash, whether they'll lend them any more. And I've had that happen to me 2 or 3 times. So that there's a few things that are going on there. But I mean, I don't want to sort of spruik my own business, but I do it for a reason, and that is that if you really are struggling, I'm almost reluctant to do it, because there's a lot of people that charge a lot of money for it, which there's a lot of people in the buyer advocacy world that I believe, you know, charge extortionate amounts of money and perhaps don't do a great job. But finding a really good advocate who can get you into the market, because they've got existing relationships with agents. And this is how I do it, you know. So you have relationships with agents, you get through off-market listings first, you know how to negotiate, so you know how to make the decisions, do the research, and get an offer down quickly, feeling confident that you're not overpaying even in this market. That's worth some money and worth some spending if you're really struggling. yeah, you know, I mean, that those are the things that I would recommend for that. But, you know, like I said, it's very difficult. But you've got to make a compromise. Why are you going to hang around for 18 months? You know, what are you going to do in that time? Hope that COVID-2 comes along. And
well, this is the whole downside-upside piece as well, isn't it? Because we know that international arrivals are coming. And that's, you know, that's a positive price pressure indication, isn't it? Short of that, where else can it go? Interest rates probably can't get much lower.
I think the thing is, if things get quite bad, then house prices go down. But if things get a little bit bad and interest rates keep falling, then that provides at least some support.
As Damien said, I mean, you can obviously they can lower the term funding facility. So instead of allowing commercial banks to borrow at 0.1%, they can get paid to lend. That's one thing. They could also extend the mortgage term from 30 years in Australia to 50 or 70, like they've done in Japan. Well, I think Japan's 100. They could also reduce the repayment buffer. APRA could do that, although I doubt they would, which makes... You know, you can borrow more money. There's a whole bunch of stuff they can do to basically manipulate the mortgage market to make it even cheaper, which is one of the key areas where I failed last year when I was, you know, tipping a pretty big house price correction. I thought that interest rates had bottomed, but then didn't realize the term funding facility had been announced. I didn't even see it until 3 months or 4 months later. And then that completely changed the mortgage market. Then obviously the government's getting rid of responsible lending laws as well, or trying to. So there's all this sort of stuff that can still, you know, make it even more attractive. But
I guess it's probably the most important point there, though, out of that, is that we're not in a real market in terms of interest rates. It's government funded. And so
it's backstopped, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, too big to fail.
Yeah, but it's also the point about saying they're trying to lend as much as they can. They're basically saying, you know, let responsible lending standards be damned. Yep. Just pump the money out as fast as you can. And here's some free money, effectively free money for banks to get out and push. And so, I guess I spoke about one downside about things getting really bad. The other downside is if things are improving, but the governments and central banks think that they're improving better than they are, and then they start winding this stuff back, and they say, okay, maybe we should be responsible with the lending, and maybe you know, interest rates, maybe we shouldn't give banks free money anymore. We should start, you know, charging a bit more for it. That's where you could have a shock to the system as well.
Which would kind of be a repeat of
policy area.
That's right. And that would basically be a repeat of what we had during the Royal Commission times, when we had a correction that was caused by bit of macroprudential tightening, bit of debate about Labor getting rid of lending and gearing.
It was expectation of, as the banks expecting to get, the Royal Commission's out there saying, you should crack down on all these areas. And so the banks were like, well, we better wind back on that stuff now before we get, get more trouble.
And the market literally turned as soon as the 2018 federal election happened and the coalition unexpectedly won.
Yes.
And the negative gearing reforms got scrapped and the market automatically rebounded. So, Damien's point there is we could end up getting a, you know, situation like that where we have another dip, like the last correction.
So I guess what I'm saying is and it's what we've been saying with the markets for us as well, is that, you know, we're invested at the moment, but because everything's fake and everything's all supported by all government programs and spending, if there's policy error, that's where your risk is on the downside.
Because government can't save government. Well, maybe they can unwind the errors they've made, but...
That's right. But chances are, by the time they've actually made a change, they'll stick with it for 6 months before they admit it they're wrong and then reverse it.
And then we might be off to the races again.
Yeah, that is your big danger.
Yep.
Actually, Catherine, so I've got a couple of questions as well, just from viewers around the idea of developers. So I might jump in quickly first. I think we spoke certainly been speaking to people last year and finding that there was still – it was still quite difficult. While lending to ordinary investors bounced back and willingness to lend, the banks were still quite circumspect about lending to developers. I guess the indications we're having at the moment is that that's starting to free up for small developers, but for larger developers, it's still quite troubled. I don't know if you've got any insight into that area.
Yeah, it's still very difficult, and part of that is because the land prices are pushing up so high that for a developer, he has to obviously, do a feasibility, and the feasibility has to show a profit. And so, for example, take a smaller developer that's looking at a land site and they want to develop 4 townhouses, and they're having to compete in a market that's not just made with developers that are doing feasibilities, but speculators and people that want to buy it and sit on the land and so forth. The prices of the townhouses are not high enough yet. They're not going up at such a pace that it's making the projects feasible. So it's firstly very difficult for somebody that wants to develop straight away and sell out and come out with a profit to do a development, to find the land to do a development. And yeah, the banks are still, they're not, this idea that the banks are suddenly going to start tightening up, I don't see that at all, because there's still quite a few hoops you have to jump through as a normal lender, let alone a developer. And they say the developers is the highest risk, if anything, to get financed. So it's still very challenging for developers to get in.
So that's going to have some supply issues, do you think, down the track?
Down the track, probably. I think we've kind of all seen that happen in certain sectors. But this is where you have to sort of split the housing market up. I mean, the supply that we kind of always needed was this kind of family-sized accommodation.
Mm.
Close in the schools where the people actually want to live and send their kids to the established schools that have got a reputation. Mm-hmm. And in those areas, that's where you get problems with council zoning and what they will allow. And then you're not going to get any stock that's going to be built because developers are greedy. Why not?
Mm.
that's the system that we've built for them. And so they want to make a profit. So we were never going to have a flood of stock come on. The first home buyers and the home builder grant, well, that's all flooding out to the new estates,
mm.
which typically go nowhere for a few years before you ever see any kind of like inflation go up there. And then the schools, the delay in the infrastructure and everything being built there. So it's advantage to the big companies, the big development companies. It's like the construction industry, right? So much has been poured into the construction industry. And in the city, in Melbourne, I know that Sydney's going through a little bit more of a complex situation with their planning process. But in Melbourne, there's been a whole heap of high-rise apartment buildings that have been fast-tracked through. And one of the reasons that we'll get the students back is not to save the universities, but to save the apartment sector, along with the RBA's, great apartment shortage, paper that they wrote. And all of this stuff coming out, Triggerboff, who's come out and said, just these planning changes that are going on are just terrible because, it's putting up the price of apartments. So, it's interesting with that side of things. So it is kind of like a split up market, when it comes to supply. And that's, that's the problem with it, really. But the smaller developers, it's not easy being a small developer,
mm-hmm.
and trying to make money from doing small developments.
Mm.
And there's certainly not a lot of property on the market, which gives that opportunity.
Okay, very good. Getting close to time. I just wanted to actually just quickly finish on one. And you had an article out, I think, today on international investors, so property investors, and how it's obviously crated.
Yep.
Have you been fielding, or I guess from the coalface, or do you expect, or what do you expect of the international property investment sort of side of things now and then obviously in the future when the sort of the iron curtain's lifted and everyone can flood back in again?
Is there another bit of pent-up demand?
Yeah, that's right. Are we going to get a final fillip after our own internal boom? Are we going to have an international investor-led boom to sort of put the cherry on the top?
Are you asking me?
Yes, Catherine. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, look, it's definitely think we would have more flooding in if it makes sense to purchase here. You certainly see it in other markets like the US and in areas of Europe where you have a lot of international buying going on. So I don't see that would not be feasible, but I don't get a massive amount of inquiry from international buyers. There was only, we kind of went through that Asian buying period, when they let down the rules after the global financial crisis, the Kevin Rudd. Do you remember that with dial up the 1-300 number if you see an Asian at an auction?
Yeah, that was around 2015 when when foreign buyers were accounting for about 8 to 10% of established houses.
Yeah, that's a Joe Hockey thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And yeah. So they, but it's now fallen, according to the NAB property survey, it's fallen to about 2%. So,
okay.
Actually, it might even be 1.5% for the article went up yesterday with the data. So,
but
it's collapsed.
It's an interesting thing. Like, there's probably, as I said, there's probably another couple of percent demand once you roll back that initial boom.
Yep.
People pent up. Mm. Yeah, so I wanted to buy in Australia and they did it right in coronavirus, and now once I can get there, I'll look around and buy
some. Well, so it's like, I mean, obviously it's a lot harder to buy when you can't even fly in here and check it out.
Yeah. Well, the other thought too is obviously the Asian part of the COVID piece was, you know, relatively benign compared to perhaps Europeans' experience and the US, et cetera. So there might be a chance where once people can get out of their country and haven't had a great time through their own national COVID experience, that Australia suddenly looks like it's well in front.
And New Zealand.
And New Zealand, of course, as well. Well, they've had a few issues of late with their property prices, haven't they? Very good. Oh.
Yeah, they need to come and buy the apartments, all the empty apartments.
Well, they might be cheap. Do you think, actually, just finally, as a value investor, do you think, you know, if we continue to see a bit of a bloodbath in the apartment piece, obviously you've got your feelings, and I think they're correct in the fact they don't have land, but is that going to be a target area for people that do want to invest in, you know, in apartments? Is it going to see some value there?
Yeah, it has been and it still is. I mean, because, you know, I still come across some property managers that are having problems with absentee landlords, you know, difficulty with communication and that. So there's still, you know, a fair proportion. I mean, I'm only talking anecdotally. I don't have a lot of personal experience with international buyers.
Fair enough.
Not in Australia anyway.
Wonderful. All right. Well, look, on that note, thanks very much for joining us. Always terrific to have you on the show. Catherine, couldn't be here in person this time, but that's okay. Always wonderful for you to share your thoughts and experiences on the front line of the Melbourne property market. For those listening in, would you like to share how they can get in touch with you and follow some of your work?
Yeah, for sure. You can go to my website, if you like, which is cashmoreco.com.au. There's the Prosper website. We always appreciate support. Work very hard there, prosper.org.au. Or you can sign up and read what I write at Port Phillip Publishing's Fat Tail Media, fattailmedia.com.au. And there's a couple of publications there which I write, which are hugely insightful, well worth signing up to.
Very good. I'm just going to quickly check for any last questions. I think we're pretty good from the chat line. So on that note, we'll thank you again for your time today, and we'll look forward to getting you back on very soon.
Beautiful. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thanks, Catherine.
And thanks to you, Leith and Damien, as well, for another great show. We'll roll into our viewer question of the week. How long do you think the boom will last? And if you like, and as many people have said, there's no such thing as one housing market. There's lots of little markets. So if you can share some insights on perhaps your market and your thoughts on how your area is going, we always enjoy reading those. So feel free to drop in your answers in the comments box of our YouTube video here. Coming up next week, we continue the property theme with friend of the show and emerging financial media guru Martin North back on the show to take a considered look at the emerging two-speed economy in the Australian property market between detached housing and apartments. Combined with this, the country's property party is likely to heat up even further as we've gone through today with the rejoining of investors to the market that have long sat on the sidelines. Martin, who of course is founder of boutique research firm Digital Finance Analytics, joins us to share his research and thoughts on the bifurcation of our surging housing market with a special look at rental yields throughout our major capitals. So tune in next week, Thursday the 29th of April at 12:30 p.m. for what promises to be a big show on a big topic. Thanks again to all of those that have watched in live for another great episode, and to all of those who have asked questions. I hope you've taken away some great ideas, and if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And don't forget to check out our sister show, Nucleus Empower, which is available on our YouTube channel. Empower explores the personal finance areas and aims to give you plenty of information on ways to take control of your finances. To stay up to date with news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team, and we'll look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.